When the Queen was crowned, they gave her a Bible. And these were the words they used when they gave it. Here is wisdom. Here is the royal law. Here are the lively oracles of God. I wonder if she ever reads that Bible. Several thousand times during the week, in the law courts of this country, a Bible is produced and a witness is asked to swear upon it, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I wonder if it makes any difference to their testimony. If you go into almost any hotel or hospital in this country, there's a good chance there you'll find a Bible by the bedside. I wonder how many people use it. According to the statistics I have, the Bible has been translated, or at least parts of it have, into over 1,500 languages. And tens of millions of copies are distributed throughout the world every year. Do you think it's worth all that effort? The Bible is certainly reverenced, isn't it? It's a bestseller. But is it studied? Is it read? Because it used to be. In Victorian England, the habit of daily Bible reading in the family was very widespread. So was it in Puritan England in the 17th century. But the truth of the matter is today, most people, at least in this country, though they may have the Bible on the shelf, almost everybody does, they in fact never turn its pages, not in the way our great-grandfathers did. Bible reading has become to a large extent past. It's no use. It's not done anymore. And there can't be any doubt, I think, that one of the major reasons for that is that somehow the suspicion has got through to the man in the street that the Bible isn't reliable, that you can't trust it. I want us to look at two facets of that particular doubt that's cast on the Bible in order to try and cope with this old chestnut tonight. First, the text is unreliable, and secondly, the facts are unreliable. Start with the text first. There are many people who will tell you, well, you know, we've got no autographed originals. The Bible is a compilation of 66 books, 39 in the Old Testament, 27 in the New, and all the manuscripts we have are copies. Well, surely the Bible text then is going to be hopelessly corrupt as a result of all that copying over so many years. The text, the very words, can't be certain. They can't be reliable. Now, that's a very common objection, but the answer to it, I think, has to be an emphatic no. We can, in fact, be quite certain of the authenticity of the overwhelming majority of the Bible's text. Let me give you some of the reasons why that's so. The first reason for that is the antiquity of the sources we have for the Bible. That's particularly true of the New Testament. We have codices of the complete New Testament, a number of them. One very famous one is in the British Museum, the Codex Sinaiticus. And these were written down roughly 300 years after the New Testament was actually written. Now, that may seem a long while, 300 years, but you know, it is in fact a comparatively short time when you compare it to the gap between the writing of many of the great classical books and the earliest copies, the earliest manuscripts we have of them. For instance, I expect some of you did Latin at school. It's not done so often now, but if you did, I guarantee you had to read some Caesar, probably his Gallic Wars, always throwing legions across rivers and things, wasn't he? Well, Caesar's Gallic Wars, of course, was written around just before the time of Christ. But the earliest surviving complete manuscript we have is 1,000 years after that, A.D. 900. Some of you may have had to read a bit of Catullus. I remember I had to read Catullus for O-level. He liked to write poems about how many times he intended to kiss his girlfriend, I remember. Well, the earliest copy we have of Catullus, another Latin author, 1,600 years after the event. The earliest copies we have of Plato, 1,200 years after the event. The earliest copies we have of Sophocles, 1,400 years. Now you see, the manuscripts of the New Testament, good manuscripts of the New Testament, are much closer to the original than these Greek and Latin classics. That puts it in perspective, I think. The antiquity of the sources, then, means that we can be sure of the text, because nobody really seriously questions the authenticity of these classical texts, even though the copies are so remote from the original pen. Another reason we can be sure of them is the number of sources, and this perhaps is even more important. Do you know, for the New Testament, we have 4,000 early manuscripts or portions from different periods and different traditions. Now, again, that's far more than we have for the classics. For Caesar's Gallic Wars, about a dozen copies, I understand. For Tacitus's famous annals, two copies. And in addition to these, a huge number of manuscripts and portions, we have many papyrus fragments, just little pieces of New Testament books, which go back much further than the earliest complete manuscripts. Now, Bill mentioned one of them, the famous John Ryland's papyrus of John, which is dated, he said, right around AD 130 or something, perhaps only 30 years after John wrote the Gospel. Another famous one is the Chester Beatty papyrus, which was fragments of the Gospels and of Acts. So, what this means, of course, you see, is that by cross-checking all these hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts, it's possible for scholars to identify where copyists' mistakes have crept in. And then they can make good judgments on the original reading. Many people get rather disturbed when they read their Bible and they find at the bottom a margin which says, "A few manuscripts read," or something like that. Oh, they say, we can't have that sort of doubt coming in to our Bible. We can't have bits in the margin, not knowing which is right and which is wrong. But you see, the really important thing is that the scholars actually know that there are alternative readings. That's really very important. They can actually measure the reliability of the text in that way. And the marginal references we have are the best possible testimony to the confidence which textual critics feel in the vast majority of the text. They can actually measure where the text has diverted in some way because of a copyist's change. When you come to the Old Testament, it is admittedly not quite such a good situation. Old Testament manuscripts, of course, were written in Hebrew, apart from a small part of Daniel that's written in Aramaic. And until comparatively recently, we only had what's called the Masoretic text to go on for the Old Testament. Now, that was a text which was written by Jewish scribes who worked between the 5th century and the 9th century. Their job was to introduce vowels into the text. Hebrew is written, if you can believe it, without any vowels in at all, just consonants. And, well, it was always said that because of the Jewish reverence for the text, that consonantal text, which was the original Hebrew version of the Old Testament, that would have been preserved with painstaking accuracy. But though people felt sure that was true, because particularly around that period, the Jews almost reverenced the Bible to the point of idolatry, although people always said that was true, there was no real check available. There were some old translations of the Old Testament. There was a translation into Aramaic and a more famous translation into Greek called the Septuagint, which were dated in, say, 200 BC, something around there. But they weren't very good translations. And although sometimes people felt, well, maybe that translation is reflecting a different Hebrew original than the one we've got in the Masoretic text, it was difficult to be sure. But in 1947, something happened that really dramatically changed that. A Bedouin shepherd herding his flocks, predictably he was called Mohammed, he was herding his flocks northwest of the Dead Sea, and he found there a cave. And inside the cave, a jar. The place was called Wadi Qumran. And what he found inside the jar, of course, were the beginnings of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, the reason those Dead Sea Scrolls caused such a sensation when they were published back in the 50s was because here was a vital check, the check that was needed. Here were papyrus copies in Hebrew of the Old Testament books predating our previous early manuscripts by 1,000 years. Imagine that, 1,000-year gap between those Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text, or at least some of those Dead Sea Scrolls. So you see, you have a marvelous way of checking the Hebrew text of the Bible with this huge time gap to see how many changes have come in that period. And the fascinating thing is that whilst there are some interesting alternative readings in the Dead Sea Scrolls that do influence some early and some modern translations, the number of changes really that are required by them are extraordinarily few. So when it comes to the text of the Bible then, though it is often said, well, it must be full of errors and corruptions because it's been copied so often, people who say that are really only expressing their ignorance of the true facts. And I think perhaps if you hear anybody say that, you ought to put your foot firmly on their neck and tell them where the truth lies. Because that one really can't be borne. And I don't think any scholar would entertain the kind of huge doubts about the text which some lay people seem to think they ought to entertain. But then we come to the other area of unreliability that people are always introducing. The facts are unreliable, they say. Now, this derives, as Bill was hinting earlier, from a number of things. Sometimes it arises from conflicts with what people take to be science, but more often it arises from conflicts arising from history. People feel that the books of the Bible were not written by those who are supposed to have written them. They weren't written when they were supposed to have been written, and as a result, they are full of historical mistakes, having been written a long time after the actual events they record, and by people who don't know anything about them. Now, to give you two classic examples of this kind of criticism of the Bible, which it is true does have a scholarly kind of weight behind it, I suppose the classic in the Old Testament is the Pentateuch. A chap called Wellhausen, who is famous for having reshaped the whole theory of the Pentateuchal criticism in this century, he suggested some years ago now, half a century ago now, that in fact the Pentateuch, that's the first five books of the Bible, the books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, those first five books weren't written by Moses at all. They were, in fact, he says, a compilation of a number of authors and editors who have reworked the material again and again, pulling in their own material, putting it together. For instance, he says that he could detect in the Pentateuch, first of all, a strand which he called J. And he called it J because he reckoned that that author tended to call God by the name Jehovah. And that was written, he said, around the 9th century BC, which is still quite a long while after Moses. Then he said there's another strand, which he labelled E. He labelled it that because he reckoned that author tended to use the name Elohim, God Almighty, as it's often translated, for the word God in his version. That was written about the 8th century, he said, and then somebody came along and put J and E together. And as a result, he says, as you read your Old Testament, you might come to a bit in the chapter, and suddenly that would stop being J and start being E. Or you might even have a verse, half of which was J and half of which was E. So the two things had been conflated, you see, in that way. Then he said there was another strand, which he labelled D, which comprises Deuteronomy, basically. That, he said, was written in the 7th century. You may remember, if you know the Old Testament at all, that in the time of Josiah, they rediscovered the law. And Josiah began a great reform, holding the Passover and doing a lot about the idolatry, because the priests had discovered the law in the temple. And we get this picture of them sort of discovering this faded manuscript and blowing the dust on it and saying, boy, oh boy, King Josiah will be interested in this, and rushing in to see the king and showing him it. Now, Wellhausen thought that was almost unlikely, and obviously what these priests had done was actually just written the book of Deuteronomy. And the ink was barely dry on the page when they took it to Josiah, because the book of Deuteronomy was actually written at that period of time, or just before. And then he said there was another strand called the priestly strand, P, which comes perhaps from nearer the time of Ezra, and which is very interested in all the priestly code and all the ritual and so on, which Wellhausen didn't believe really existed in Israel much before the time of Ezra, when the cultic side, the ceremonial side of Israelite religion really took off. So there are these four strands coming from a period of time embracing perhaps 500 years, woven together, he said, to make the Pentateuch. In the New Testament, a sort of corresponding area of debate, as we were saying a bit earlier, is the Gospels. Because the Gospels have four accounts of the same events, as we were saying, and so it's very tempting to some scholar to try and work out what was the real original tradition. Many of these scholars believe that, in fact, the church was responsible for most of what we find in the Gospels, and that these words and actions are very largely written back into the mouth of Jesus, and that we really have a very garbled account of what actually happened to the real Jesus of Nazareth. In fact, some scholars would express great doubt whether you could get to the real Jesus of Nazareth at all behind the witness of the church to him, which grew up after his death. And so the gospel criticism, what's sometimes called redaction criticism, has been a similar minefield of literary criticism as far as the New Testament is concerned. Now, what are we to say about these kinds of arguments? You will find people who've read a little bit, who've got a smattering of modern reading in Bible critics, and they will throw these things out, and they will say, well, there you are, you see. It's all that the Bible wasn't written when it was said it was written. It wasn't written by the people it's supposed to have been written by. And therefore, it's full of historical inaccuracies and so on. How are we to reply to them? Well, I think, let me give you just a few suggestions as to how I would want to reply. First of all, I think it's very important to take up what Bill was saying earlier about archaeology. Because, you see, much of the kind of sweeping generalizations that are made, whether about the gospel writers or about the Pentateuch, are based on assumptions about history which aren't supported by the evidence. It was very easy earlier in this century, you see, to make sweeping statements, like, for instance, well, of course Moses couldn't have written the Pentateuch. Writing wasn't known when Moses was alive. Well, that was quite conventionally said at the end of the last century, as an obvious reason why Moses could not have written the Pentateuch. It was easy to say then, because of course nobody knew. But now archaeologists have done a bit of digging. They have found cuneiform tablets going back 3,000 BC. Well, Moses, what, 1,200, 1,500, depending on exactly when you place him? But certainly considerably after 3,000 BC. Of course writing was known in Moses' day. There's absolutely no reason why Moses shouldn't have used written sources if he'd wanted to. And I suspect strongly he did. Then there are these patriarchal stories, you see. Wellhausen and his school were absolutely convinced that this was all legend, written up later on to try and provide a kind of mythological framework of self-understanding for Israel as a nation. He was quite sure nothing got written down or even thought about much before the time of the entry into Canaan and Israel's birth as a nation. But as Bill was saying, now archaeologists have discovered clay tablets from the patriarchal period in the Middle East, places with the entertaining names of Mari and Nuzi. And these are social and legal and documents of that kind, and they give a fascinating picture of the economic and social background of the Old Testament in the patriarchal period. And it is quite obvious from reading those texts, that the stories in Genesis about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and so on, they fit into the scene. Now, if somebody had been writing hundreds of years later and trying to guess what it had been like in the Middle East, say, half a millennium earlier, without written historical sources to guide them, how would they have known? Just to give you an example, you may come across in the book of Genesis sometimes a funny phrase called household gods, the teraphim. They're rather odd things. They were obviously rather important to people because we find people being very particular about who's got them and who hasn't. Well, now you see, these texts have shown to us why people were so concerned about these so-called household gods, as they were called. They were a title deed to an inheritance. And the person who had them got the flocks, or a good measure of them. Even the book of Deuteronomy, you know, a lot of light has been thrown on that too, against this background of Wellhausen, who wants to say it was all written miles after the time of Moses, rather than the time of Josiah. Because there are many scholars who would want to say that the book of Deuteronomy takes its shape from a particular kind of treaty which the Hittites and people of that ilk used. When a king conquered a country, he made a treaty with it. And he said, now listen here, I'll protect you, provided you keep my laws. We're going to have a contract, right? It was an imposed treaty. The people didn't have much choice about it, because he'd conquered them. But it was a legally binding document. He would protect them, he would be their king, they would be his vassal state, and they would keep his laws. And the book of Deuteronomy is shaped and styled very much after the pattern of one of these Hittite vassal treaties. In fact, one book has been written called The Treaty of the Great King on Deuteronomy, which suggests that what God has done in Deuteronomy is to write his own vassal treaty with Israel as his vassal nation. He's the conquering king, they're his vassal people, I'll protect you, he says, you keep my laws. Well, now, Hittite vassal treaties, you see, come from that period, the period of Moses and so on. And to suggest that they come from the time of Josiah would be an anachronism. The whole style, the frame of the book would be irrelevant to people in that period. Dr. Lehman, who was actually an expert in Hittite law back in the 50s, he's written, speaking about one particular passage in the Pentateuch, it is permeated with a knowledge of Hittite law and customs so correctly corresponding to the period that, with the destruction of the Hattu, says, I'm afraid I couldn't find out who they were exactly, but anyway, with the destruction of their kingdom around 1200 BC, these laws fell into oblivion. So he says a late date for this part of the Pentateuch must be rejected. Archaeologists, you see, who actually investigate these things are saying things like that these days. And it really does rule out an awful lot of the kind of nonsense that people like Wellhausen said. When it comes to the New Testament, you know, we're even better served by archaeology. There are a number of references, of course, to Jesus and contemporary events in historians of the period, which confirm his reputation as a worker of miracles and his death at the hands of the Romans and so on. But when you come particularly to the writings of Luke, Luke is so particular about his history that he unwittingly, perhaps, provides us with a huge opportunity to check his accuracy. And now that archaeologists have started digging up ancient Greece and the area of Asia in which the New Testament comes from, they're beginning to discover that Luke is phenomenally accurate. One man who did an enormous amount of work of this kind a few years ago is called William Ramsay. He started working on the book of Acts, working on the theory that it was written in the 2nd century AD by a person who wasn't an eyewitness. That was the conventional opinion. But he was compelled by the archaeological discoveries which he made to conclude that it must have been written by somebody with an intimate knowledge of the Roman Empire and the events involved. Just to take one very impressive example, which he cites in one of his books, Luke is extraordinarily accurate when it comes to giving the titles of various officials in the Roman Empire. I don't know if any of you know anything about Oxford, but at Oxford, the heads of the colleges all have different names. They're rectors, provosts, masters, and probably a couple of others I can't think of. And if you don't know anything about Oxford, you get in a frightful muddle. Getting it right is a real feat. And that was the sort of problem which Luke had. There are all different kinds of titles for Roman officials in the ancient world, and the differences were very subtle. What's more, a slight change in the political status of a province would change the title, so that within the space of 10 or 15 years, you might be a proconsul one year and something else the next year. Well, as a result of his work on inscriptions and so on, Ramsay was able to check Luke in numbers of occasions to see whether he was right, and he always was. Something is very hard to believe that somebody writing 100 years later, say, could possibly be. He'd have to make a guess at what the official was called, and he'd almost certainly be wrong, just the law of statistics would decree that. But Luke gets it right every time. And that's one of the things which led Ramsay to this conclusion. He says here, Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he is possessed of the true historic sense. He fixes his mind on the idea and plan that rules in the evolution of history and proportions the scale of his treatment to the importance of each incident. He seizes the important and critical events and shows their true nature at greater length while he touches lightly or omits entirely much that was valueless for his purpose. In short, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians. Well, that might be overstating it. Ramsay did get a bit euphoric about Luke by the time he'd finished his studies. But it shows you that a scholar working in the field of archaeology actually comes to quite different conclusions than the kind of skeptical critics who are assuming gaily that the Gospels couldn't possibly be accurate. So that's one whole area of response to this suggestion that the facts are unreliable. Ask people to look at the archaeology, because the more that is dug up, the more the Bible is supported, and literary criticism is questioned. Another thing I think that has to be said about these theories of literary criticism, which are used to question the historical accuracy of the Bible, is that they do rest on a great many gratuitous and unprovable assumptions. For instance, Wellhausen's theory rests on the assumption that religion evolves. He assumes as a piece of fundamental presupposition to his work that, in the early stages, the Jews, of course, would have been animists and polytheists. And they would have only become monotheists, people who believed in one God, over a long period of time. He reckoned perhaps by the 8th century they'd got there. But of course Moses couldn't have been a monotheist. And the very patriarchs, they couldn't have believed in one God, and so on. There had to be an evolution. Same with the whole idea of the cultus, the idea of sacrifices and so on. In the early days, they must have been simple family sacrifices. And the whole idea of the priesthood and of a complex ceremonial law, that must have come much later. Now, this evolutionary theory, of course, is like the evolutionary theory of the species of Darwin. It was the kind of vogue intellectual pattern of Wellhausen's day. Everything had to evolve. History evolved, biology evolved, religion evolved. Everybody assumed it was so. But of course, there's no real reason why it should be so. It's just an assumption. Another thing one has to say about Wellhausen and his school, they were anti-supernaturalist. They took it for granted that if you found a miracle in the text, well, of course, it couldn't be historical, could it? Miracles don't happen. If you found a prophecy in the text where something was predicted that happened years later, well, of course, it couldn't have been a real prophecy. It must have been inserted after the event by somebody who knew what had happened and pretended he was predicting it. And that's the only way it could happen. This anti-supernatural prejudice is something you find, and you find it not only in Wellhausen and Old Testament, you find it in the New Testament too, when it comes to the miracles of Jesus and so on. Now, these are unproven assumptions. All right, if you don't believe miracles are possible, if you believe that religion evolves and it's impossible for people to believe in one God before they reach a certain stage of cultural development, all right. But you'll have to prove that from other studies and give good reasons for it and show concrete evidence for it. But to build it into the presuppositions and then say, well, of course that bit of the Bible can't be genuine because it's a miracle. Because it's impossible that the Jews could have believed that about God at that period. You see how gratuitous that becomes. Frankly, it's not good scholarship. And that brings us to the third thing I think one has to say about all these kinds of theories about the Bible, which tend to question the reliability of the authors and the accounts. And that is the subjectivity of the method. You take, for instance, Wellhausen's way of deciding which bit comes from J, which bit comes from E, which bit comes from P, which bit comes from D. Well, frankly, though there are criteria, vocabulary, style, theological interest, one gets the distinct impression that Wellhausen sat there and decided what Wellhausen thought came from J, and came from E, and came from D, and came from P. It's a very subjective decision. Same goes when you read what some critics say about the Gospels. Oh, there are criteria there. Redaction criticism, as it's called, has its criteria laid down as to what could have been an authentic statement of Jesus, what belongs to the original tradition, and what must have been inserted later, either by the evangelist or by the church or something. And you can sort of apply those criteria after a fashion. But again, you often get the impression that these people are just gratuitously saying, well, perhaps that bit comes from X, and perhaps that bit belongs to so-and-so. It's very subjective. One person who ought to know about these things and was certainly incensed by the subjectivity of much biblical scholarship was C.S. Lewis. Now, C.S. Lewis, of course, was specially qualified to talk about this because he was himself a literary critic. He is a man who wrote books and who spent a lot of time analyzing books as a professor of English. And in an essay he wrote, Fern, Seed, and Elephants, he actually comments, as a literary critic, upon the literary criticism of the Bible that he had come across. It's a little bit entertaining, I think. He says here, I published a book of essays, and the one into which I had put most of my heart, the one I really cared about, and in which I discharged a keen enthusiasm, was on William Morris. In almost the first review of my book, I was told that this was obviously the only one in the book in which I had felt no interest. Now, don't mistake, the critic was, I now believe, quite right in thinking it was the worst essay in the book. At least everyone agreed with him. Where he was totally wrong was in his imaginary history of the causes which produced its dullness. This made me prick up my ears. Since then, I have watched with some care similar imaginary histories, both of my own books and the books of my friends, whose real history I knew. Reviewers, both friendly and hostile, will dash you off such histories with great confidence, will tell you what public events had directed the author's mind to this or that, what other authors had influenced him, what his overall intention was, what sort of audience he principally addressed, why and when he did everything. Now, I must first record my impression, and then, distinct from it, what I can say with certainty. My impression is that in the whole of my experience, not one of these guesses has on any one point been right. That this method shows a record of 100% failure. You would expect that by mere chance they would hit as often as they miss, but it is my impression they do no such thing. I can't remember a single hit. But as I have not kept a careful record, my mere impression may be mistaken. What I think I can say with certainty is that they are usually wrong. And yet they would often sound, if you didn't know the truth, extremely convincing. Many reviewers, for instance, said that the ring in Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings was suggested by the atom bomb. What could be more plausible? Here is a book published when everyone was preoccupied by that sinister invention. Here in the centre of the book is a weapon which it seems madness to throw away, yet fatal to use. Yet in fact, the chronology of the book's composition makes that theory impossible. Again, only the other week, a reviewer said that a fairy tale by my friend Roger Green was influenced by fairy tales of mine. Nothing could be more probable. I have an imaginary country with a beneficent lion in it. Green has one with a beneficent tiger. Green and I can be proved to read one another's work, to be indeed in various ways closely associated. The case for an affiliation is far stronger than many which we accept as conclusive when dead authors are concerned. But it's all untrue, nevertheless. I know the genesis of that tiger and that lion, and they are quite independent. Now, this surely ought to give us pause. The reconstruction of the history of a text, when that text is ancient, may sound very convincing. But one is, after all, sailing by dead reckoning. The results cannot be checked by fact. In order to decide how reliable the method is, what more could you ask for than to be shown an instance where the same method is at work and we have facts to check it by? Well, that is what I have done. And we find that when this check is available, the results are either always or else nearly always wrong. The, quote, assured results of modern scholarship as to the way in which an old book was written are assured, we may conclude, only because the men who knew the facts are dead and can't blow the gaff. Well, that's C.S. Lewis, and I think as time goes by, more and more people will probably come to see the wisdom of his words. There it is then. The text is unreliable? No, definitely not. Even scholars wouldn't agree there. The facts are unreliable? Well, I agree you can find skeptical scholars who will cast all kinds of doubts into your mind about the authenticity of the Bible, history, the things it says happened, and so on. But I suggest to you that better scholarship, more archaeology, more humility, a little more integrity even, might make them a little more cautious about the things they so sweepingly say. The text is trustworthy, the literary integrity of the Bible can be defended, and there are many, many conservative, well-read scholars who would have no hesitation in defending it. The historical accuracy of the Bible can be tested by archaeology in lots and lots of ways, and again and again and again, it is proving itself true. And that, of course, is why intelligent people in this city of Cambridge, who do know something about it, think they can believe the Bible is the inspired word of God and therefore infallible without mistakes, and hold that with real intellectual integrity. Now, I hope you don't think that the likes of Bill and others, perhaps, whom you've met around this church, are sort of sitting there in their study, reading the Bible, and, of course, knowing deep down in their hearts that it's all a load of rubbish, but coming along to church with it under their arms and pretending that they really believe it's all true. I hope you give them more credit than that. But, of course, there is a larger question, isn't there, about the Bible? And this is the one really I've got to leave you with. Is the Bible reliable as to its text? Is the Bible reliable as to its facts? On those things, we can say something. But is the Bible reliable as a way to direct you to God? Is it reliable as a map, like Bill was saying, to show you the way to heaven? That's what the Bible claims to be. That's the purpose the Bible says God has given it to us, to show us the way. Your word, O Lord, is eternal. It stands firm in the heavens, a lamp to my feet, a light for my path, says the psalmist. He says his life is a pretty dangerous one. I constantly take my life in my hands. How glad he is to have the Bible stabilizing him in that situation. He feels very often he could go astray, that he's in moral danger, that he can easily slip into temptation. How glad he is, he says, to have the Bible there, to show him the right way and give him the strength to take the right path. Most of all, he says the Bible is a delight to him. Do you notice how often he says that? Sweeter than honey to my mouth. But you see, the only way you can tell whether honey is sweet is by tasting it for yourself. Now, have you done that? Most of the people who tell me the Bible is unreliable are people who've never read it, actually. Have you read it? I do urge you to do that. Because if my experience and Bill's is anything to go on, yes, and many dozens of people here tonight, when you make that experiment and start reading the Bible for yourself, you will find, as the psalmist found, it is sweeter than honey, and it will take you to heaven. Let's pray together.